From Uniontown to Harrisburg, Bradford to Lansford, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, is the push to raise the state's minimum wage the result of a public education system that has failed to equip students to find better jobs? Political and economic analyst Jake Novak joins us for a policy discussion. As many workers continue to work from home, the result is rising office vacancy rates. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report on the impact. And State House Democrats are propping up a broken system of public education while denying students the opportunity to select better options. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Jake Novak in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. According to the Center Square, a bill to alter the state's public school formula that passed the House of Representatives this past week would place new regulations and cap the available funds for charter schools. Dr. Ann Clark, CEO of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Public Charter Schools, says the proposed funding formula ignores the financial realities of running cyber charter schools, which often give students and parents the option of escaping from underperforming traditional public schools or who have different educational needs. House Democrats are determined to prevent student choice, but the bill now heads to the state Senate, where it has little chance of passing in its current form, as expanding choice options is the top priority of Senate Republicans. Meanwhile, a state Senate-approved proposal to cut the state's personal income tax from 3.07% to 2.8% and to eliminate the gross receipts tax on electricity was the subject of a hearing this past week by the House Republican Policy Committee. The proposal, which received bipartisan support in the Senate, would allow taxpayers to keep more of their money during a time when state government is enjoying a $14 billion budget surplus. The budget deadline of June 30th is rapidly approaching. The next time you drive through a toll booth on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, you might want to snap a picture. They will soon be disappearing from the landscape as the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission has approved a $50 million contract to remove all remaining toll booths and replace them with overhead gantries. The trend nationwide is toward overhead gantries, which smooth the flow of traffic while still collecting tolls via EasyPass or toll by plate. The commission expects to save $25 million annually once all the gantries are in place. They are being phased in between now and 2027. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Legislative Democrats have been pushing for years to raise the state's minimum wage. Jake Novak is host of the Analyst Podcast with Jake Novak and Jake's Takes, which can be heard on Substack. He is here to talk about the impact of minimum wage increases and why public schools have failed to equip students to work in higher-paying jobs. Jake, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Jake, once again, the legislature here in Pennsylvania considering Democrat proposals to raise the minimum wage. We're going to talk a bit about the history and the impact of minimum wage hikes around the country, where this might go. And you have sort of a unique take on the impact of all of this. Let's start out, Jake, the history of minimum wage. It really had sort of an auspicious beginning, did it not?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was the Depression. I mean, the official minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, was set during the depths of the Depression when President Roosevelt was, and it was just one of many. I mean, one of the things about the Roosevelt Depression era policies is that there were so many of them that it's hard to kind of pinpoint on any one of them. But this, of course, minimum wage has taken on a life of its own, a little bit different than some of the other things like Social Security and the work projects, the public works projects that he implemented as well. Minimum wage has taken on a much different role than I think it had at its outset. And I think now it's become, instead of something that, you know, obviously some people felt it was intended to protect some workers. Of course, it also stopped people from getting jobs, which was really one of the purposes, actually, one of the reasons why some people supported it. But now I think it acts as a way to cover up really possibly the worst scandal in American government history, which is the failure of our public schools. No one talks about this. We know that minimum wage hurts mid-level and small businesses. We know that. And we know that large businesses sometimes support minimum wage increases because they can afford it, and it's a great way for them to kill off rising competition, small businesses that can become big businesses. But it's also the government's great way to cover up the fact that we spend millions of dollars in this country. Pennsylvania spends millions of dollars. We all spend millions of dollars, no matter where we're living, on a public education system that creates people who are not able to draw a living wage. That's a scandal. That's a scandal in this country. And by raising the minimum wage, the government is pretending that these people are well-educated, have been given good skills. That's the argument that I think more people should make about all of this and say, forget about raising the minimum wage. How about raising the quality of our public education so that people don't have to get that kind of a handout, really?
From a business perspective, or actually from just the laws of economics here, Jake, in terms of the minimum wage, can a business survive long if it's paying somebody more than the value that they bring to the product or service they are providing?
No. I mean, listen, we've already seen it in places like California with their infamous $20 minimum wage for people working in the fast food industry. Now, this is great for McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King. They can afford that electronic kiosk, Loman. They can do that. But the smaller taqueria, the smaller sandwich shop can't. They also can't afford to pay their delivery guys $20 an hour. So some of them are going out of business. Even some of the larger ones are going out of business. It's a very large chain in California of seafood, again, 50, 60 locations. That's not a small business. And they're going out of business too. So it doesn't work economically. But you know what? Again, I'm going to go back to the other point. It also doesn't work for even large businesses. Doesn't matter if you're a big hedge fund. Doesn't matter whether you're McDonald's. If you are in a municipality or a city or a state where the average high school graduate can't do any job at all for you, whether it's cashier or mop guy or anything, isn't qualified to do any of those things, that's also economically devastating.
Doesn't that then bring us back to the whole education issue? Because here in Pennsylvania, Jake, the big debate going on right now in the budget that's due at the end of this month, the Democrats wanting to spend $1 billion, you talked about millions added to public education. They want to spend $1 billion more this year and $5 billion more overall in education. Yet, despite all of that, as they put it, investment in public education, we're not equipping people for something better than just a minimum wage job.
Let's be careful with our wording. And I know, listen, this is what we have to do, but it's great to stop, call time out every once in a while. They're not spending billions of dollars more education. They're spending billions more on the teachers' pensions. They're spending billions of dollars more to cover the Viagra and other retirement medical health care costs. In cities all across the country, when they say we're increasing our education funding, or in states all over the country like Pennsylvania, what they really mean is they're covering the costs of things that are really not directly related to education. There may be one or two classrooms or one of those smart boards they put in front of classes now instead of blackboards that get added, but it'll be a pittance. The real money is going towards the pensions. The real money is going towards retirement medical benefits. There are cities like Milwaukee, Loman, by the way, where they spend more money on the retirement medical care costs of their teachers than the entire school budget of the existing schools. That is what that's really where the money is going. So let's not pretend that it's going to good education.
Excellent points, Jake. We are talking with Jake Novak, who is host of The Analyst with Jake Novak, also the podcast Jake's Takes, which you can hear on Substack. Getting back to the whole minimum wage part of this discussion here, Jake. So you have, as you referenced, some of the larger fast food chains like McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, they can have these self-service kiosks which replace workers. So by raising the minimum wage, are we not taking jobs away from the people who need them the most?
Yes, we're absolutely doing that. And don't be surprised, Loman, if we find out over the course of history that it was lobbyists and lawyers for McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King who wrote this legislation. It's something that people need to understand about legislation at the state level especially, but it's true at the federal level as well. Lobbyists write the laws in this country. The people who are staffers for people in either it's in Harrisburg or D.C. really are just there in an advisory role. They sit there, they take a snack, and it's the lobbyist lawyers who write all the legislation. That's why lobbyist lawyers make so much money. That's why the areas around our state capitals and in Washington usually are very, very wealthy areas. The top six earning zip codes, top six out of 10 earning zip codes in America are in the D.C. area. And you'll also find that there are, wherever you go in America, even places like in New York and Albany or in Harrisburg, there's always like an enclave of wealthy people. And that is really what's going on here. They write the legislation. And so they are writing legislation that benefits them, doesn't benefit workers. I mean, the spin on this is just so incredible. It just feels like every law that's passed supposedly to help people has a tremendous spin attached to it. Meanwhile, things like the doubling of the standard deduction that was done under the Trump administration was given no spin at all. The Trump administration didn't trumpet it very much. But that really helped workers, low-level workers and blue-collar workers, more than any legislation I can remember in my lifetime. So the more the spin, Loman, I think the more it's actually not helping anyone.
Actually, when you look at it, Jake, do we really even need a minimum wage? Here at the Lincoln Institute, which produces this program, we do the Keystone Business Climate Survey. We talk to employers, businesses of all sizes, the people who are actually running businesses. And what they've told us for the past couple of years is they can't even find enough people to fill the jobs they have. So as a result, wages have gone up. Isn't the free market actually raising the minimum wage on its own without government interference?
Exactly. And this goes back to what we were talking about before. Businesses of all kinds, whether they're sophisticated technological businesses or even something like fast food, are saying that there aren't enough people who even are willing to apply to work at for these jobs. So the point, again, this all goes back to the spin. There is no real intended economic impact from anyone who's trying to push for a minimum wage hike. This is just a political impact they're hoping for. They're looking for publicity. You know, we're living in a society now where posting something on Facebook is valued more than your actual actions. And the minimum wage debate is really similar to that argument. They just want to be able to go and say, we raised the minimum wage. They don't really care about whether it had an impact on a job. They don't really care whether it helped anyone actually in the workforce. They just want to help themselves by being able to put that on a pamphlet. And you know what? It's not really worth it.
Does this also not feed inflationary pressure here? Because if you raise the minimum wage, that then has to bump up what you're paying everybody above it. Otherwise, you have, say, an employee that's been there for a long period of time. Now the person coming in is making as much, if not more, than them. As we try to get inflation under control, isn't this counterproductive to that?
Yeah, we've already seen it. And again, referring to California again. In California, where they've raised that minimum wage, now everyone is noticing that the price of a hamburger, you can get that little hamburger at some of these drive-thru places in California now, it's over $10. And that's not the meal price. That's just the sandwich. So people are now understanding that. But that goes back again to the big business aspect of it. You know, what Wall Street is really looking for right now from big, large businesses is, can they raise their prices and get away with it? They're very interested in seeing whether the companies that are raising prices are still getting the same number of sales. And that's another reason why some of these big chains are excited about this. They're excited about the raising the minimum wage because, like we said before, they can replace a lot of these workers with kiosks. They have the money to do that. It's going to drive some of their competitors out of business. It's those kids getting the avocado toast in the morning that's driving Starbucks and some of those and McDonald's crazy. They want you adding that Egg McMuffin. They don't want you to go to some small cafe that's independent. That's their biggest fear. And they enjoy this, and that this also gives them the justification to raise their prices because there's not going to be anywhere else for you to go. There's not going to be that corner store that's a little bit less where you can get coffee for less than $17 or whatever it is at Starbucks. I'm joking, but you know it's very expensive. And that's what they want. So to call that inflationary is, of course, that's absolutely true. And it's also about big business destroying small business. And anybody knows anything about economics in America, job creation in America always comes from small business. Big business has a lot of employees, but they just move it from state to state. They never actually add a net job once you reach a certain level of size in America. Small business is where job creation comes from. So if you destroy the small businesses, you're destroying job creation.
Jake Novak is host of The Analyst with Jake Novak, also Jake's Takes on Substack. Jake, want to tell us a little bit more about where we can find you for folks who want to hear your various podcasts?
Yes, especially for listeners for this topic. It's jakenovak.substack.com. Every morning, Monday through Friday, I have my morning business brief, which is not that technical, I promise. It's just basically 10, 15 stories about what you need to know, two sentences each. And then, of course, I also do something called the 5 and 3, which is the top 5 stories of the day in just 3 minutes. You can have the rest of the day to yourself. Those are all available on my Substack, jakenovak.substack.com. And that's really the best place to find all my stuff.
Jake, as always, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Rising office vacancy rates and the resulting lowering of tax assessments on those properties is impacting county and municipal governments. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi drill down into the numbers on this Allegheny Institute Report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. Today we'd like to talk about your most recent brief, which deals with the office vacancy rate, but it takes a little bit of a different angle. It's not focused on downtown Pittsburgh, but rather the suburban areas of Allegheny County, and possibly some lessons from some other places in the state of Pennsylvania as well. Can you give our listeners an idea what the latest data show regarding the office vacancy rate in suburban Allegheny County?
Absolutely. Vacancy rates, we typically think downtown Pittsburgh. And so what I did was I divided it into what's called the urban rate. And the urban rate will contain the central business district of downtown Pittsburgh, plus the fringe areas, which is the strip district, the north shore, the south side, the enclosed pieces. And then the third piece is the Oakland East End area, which covers the University of Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon, and the hospitals. That's considered the urban area. In 2016, the vacancy rate for the urban area of Pittsburgh was 13.5%. Then you look at the suburban areas, and you've got the South, and then South Point, the North, and then Northern I-79, Cranberry, East and West. You look at those suburban areas, and those suburban areas are typically a little bit higher. In the fourth quarter of 2016, that average is 19.5%. Now, in all honesty, for this study, I was mostly focused on Allegheny County, so I took the South Point out, which is in Washington County, and the Cranberry part out, which, of course, is in Butler County. So we just wanted to look at Allegheny County, and the reason we want to do that is because these vacancy rates have gotten so high, and we look at the first quarter of 2020, that urban rate is now 21.8% and the suburban rate is 22.4%. So you can see that the vacancy rates have grown over the years, particularly in response to the pandemic in 2020 when office buildings were emptied out and people were sent home. A lot of firms then instituted what's called a work from home policy. So if employees were working from home, not coming into town, and since they weren't coming into town, firms said, look, we don't need the space. We're going to reduce our footprint. And we're going to ask for concessions. We're going to move to another building. If we want to entice employees to come back into the office space, we might need to move to a better class of building, one that maybe has a fitness area or more eating spaces or a daycare center, whatever they need to try to entice employees to come back. And so you saw buildings basically emptying out to the point where some of them are actually thinking of going bankrupt or going into foreclosure. One of our landmark buildings, the Grant Building on Grant Street, right in the heart of downtown, is almost in foreclosure. They're talking about it because their main tenant, Huntington Bank, has yet to sign a lease because they don't know what their space needs are going to be. So this vacancy rate issue has really some far-reaching impacts because now it's affecting the market value of these buildings. And as the market of these buildings are starting to plummet because they're empty and not collecting rent, and the marketability is based on the rental income of the office space, they're asking for reductions to their assessments from Allegheny County. Now, for those listeners that aren't familiar or don't quite recall, Allegheny County hasn't had an assessment on property value since 2012. And because of all this movement in downtown Pittsburgh and office buildings, our big skyscrapers asking for reductions, and they're getting a lot of reductions, the value of commercial property downtown is plummeting, as is the taxes being collected by the school district, City of Pittsburgh School District, the city itself, and the county. And so those buildings are not only asking for reduced tax burdens going forward, they're also asking for reductions going backwards, refunds on overpayments.
Your brief refers to something called the absorption rate. Could you give our listeners an idea of what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. An absorption rate tracks how much space becomes leased, that become positive absorption, or how much space becomes unleased, negative absorption. And what the absorption rate is, it would give the taxing body kind of a heads up as to how that market is going. And what we had seen was that when it's negative, and then the city had been negative for quite some time, but it really became a little bit larger after the pandemic as firms were giving up space and the buildings were becoming empty. It was sort of the absorption rate serves as kind of the canary in the coal mine. And we saw that in 2019, they were pretty small. In the city, it was, as a percentage of total inventory, is 0.07%. And in the suburbs, it was a positive 0.32%. So prior to the pandemic, there wasn't wasn't a whole lot of movement. Some office space was being given up in the city. Some was being taken up in the suburbs. Now, you take that into the end of 2023, and the, you know, these are year-to-date numbers, so it's the entire year. The rates were a little higher. The suburban rate was 0.84%, but the urban rate was 2.11%. So as a percentage of total inventory, there was more office space being given up in the urban area, but there was also a lot of office space being given up in the suburbs.
We obviously covered the work from home and the having an old base year and what that means. So now, how do those things work together? What do you think is going to happen? I mean, you kind of alluded to it with what might be the effect on taxing bodies in Allegheny County with the skyscrapers in downtown. But talk about the other, the suburban areas, because they all have budgets they have to make. You have school districts that are going to be coming up here within the month making their decisions for their next year, and then the municipalities later this year.
Right. So what's happening in downtown Pittsburgh is not unique to downtown Pittsburgh. We have some areas around the county that have office buildings. And while I specifically focus on office buildings, there's also commercial issues with big box stores and shopping malls and the like. Their sales moved online and their brick and mortar stores aren't making as much money. So then they're also going to the taxing bodies and asking for a break on their tax burdens. For example, Monroeville has a lot of office building and commercial space, and the school district there, Gateway, has seen the property value fall by $69 million. Out in the west, West Allegheny lost $105 million in commercial property value, while Montour lost $89 million in commercial value. So those school districts are seeing the same thing as City of Pittsburgh school districts. Not only are they collecting fewer property taxes going forward, they're also going to be on the hook for refunds for the last couple years. So you have this perfect storm, if you will, of high vacancy rates and an old assessment value. And of course, we have something statewide for each county called the common level ratio. And that gives you an idea as to what the market value should be based on actual current sales and the assessment. If you have an up-to-date assessment, that ratio should be 1.00. The further away you get from an assessment or a base year, the smaller the CLR is going to get. And in Allegheny County, it went from 87.5 in 2021. It fell to 63.5 in 22 and 63.6% in 2023. And for 2024, it's 54.5%. And so it is causing these skyscrapers and these retailers to ask for reductions to their assessments. And these school districts, which rely so heavily on property taxes, are not really equipped to handle it. And so what we're saying is, okay, this is an Allegheny County situation at the moment, but any county across the Commonwealth that has older assessment, an older base year, a low CLR, if they have office buildings with low values, they're likely to see a lot of appeals as well. So this is strictly not an Allegheny County problem, but it could be a problem for counties across the Commonwealth.
Interesting stuff as always, Frank. It's quite a mix and a lot of policy issues to consider. So we always urge our listeners to visit our website, which is www.alleghenyinstitute.org, where they can read this brief and our archives on other issues. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi. This has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
The left is seeking to pour billions more tax dollars into a broken public education system, and at the same time are trapping students in underperforming schools by working to take away their school choice options. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
The purpose of education is to help students discover, develop, and apply their unique abilities. Each and every student in the Commonwealth and throughout this nation must have access to an education that unleashes their extraordinary potential, regardless of their family income or their zip code. Policies that move us away from a one-size-fits-all approach that dominates our current education system and closer to an environment of personalized learning where every student is empowered to realize their full potential should be the desired result of all Pennsylvanians. However, this week, House Bill 2370, an 86-page abomination, passed the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. According to House Democrats' floor comments, they believe that public school funding is still $5 billion underfunded annually, and that $5 billion on top of the billions that have already been added year after year for nearly a decade. Alas, they added more. They suggested we increase funding by $7 billion. Our education problems are certainly not monetary ones. Throwing money to the wind in hopes that it reaches the children in need is not a foundation for success. It's a foundation for poor results and higher taxes. House Bill 2370 also takes direct aim at cyber charter schools. Cyber schools have been a tremendous option for students and parents throughout the Commonwealth. They provide transparent curriculum for parents and the opportunity for non-traditional learners to excel in ways they could not in a brick-and-mortar setting. As Pennsylvanians, we should continue to embrace alternatives in education, not limit them. But limit them, House Democrats will. With the passage of one bill, they essentially placed a limitless cap on failing public schools while taking direct aim at cyber charter schools by placing arbitrary numbers of how much can follow a student. While House Democrat leadership is throwing money at a broken system, states across the nation are passing significant universal school choice legislation. The Louisiana legislature, for example, in lockstep with Governor Jeff Landry, recently passed GATOR scholarships, which stands for Giving All True Opportunity to Rise. This paves the way for universal ESAs for students across the state. With this signage of the bill, this marks the 18th state in the nation to pass ESA bills. Pennsylvania must catch up. We know this is only the beginning of House Democrats' attacks on alternative education. Cyber, charter, home, and private schools have always been a thorn in the side of the union, who, along with administrative employees, generally are the only benefactors of this spending. Educational freedom should be a right for every student and parent in this Commonwealth, regardless of what certain adults with educator dues in their campaign coffers have to say. One could understand the frustration with the traditional public school system as tens of thousands of families continue to put their children in alternative means of learning. But what we cannot comprehend is how, or more importantly, why, they are not making the proper adjustments to keep the faith of the parents in this Commonwealth. We have seen a decline in our traditional public schools for decades, and we see through our proficiency scores in math, science, English, and reading scores. The lack of an education that matches the needs of today not only hurt the individual, but leave our Commonwealth with a far less educated workforce than it should have. Instead of focusing on what is going to put our children in the best position after graduation, thinking outside of the box, and tailoring education to the individual student, our House of Representatives chose more of the same $7 billion of policy. Join our fight to demand more for our students. Head to AmericansForProsperity.org to join our movement of millions and help us fight back against more of the same from Harrisburg. This is Emily Green, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 29 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCNS-AM in Latrobe, WWCB-AM in Corry, along with WQXQ-FM in Altoona, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.